Interesting title, by the way, Heather, for this book, The Lovers Set Down Their Spoons. It really grabs your attention. Is there a story behind your title choice?
For this story, the title came to me when I wrote that line, actually. It just jumped off the page at me a little bit. It had some deeper levels to it that I could read some metaphor into, and I kind of figured out more as I continued to write the story and work with it what those deeper underlying meanings were. In that case, I was lucky with the title. Sometimes I struggle with a title. Sometimes the title appears at the beginning or at the end. In this case, I was really lucky, and I felt that title worked with the whole collection. When I started putting the stories together, there is a lot of eating and dining in the collection at large, and so I...
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that. That struck me that, and I'm not sure if it was every single story, but almost, that they were around the dining table or the kitchen or somehow around eating. Was that intentional, or that just happened that way?
You know, it was not intentional, and I didn't even realize how much I write dining scenes until I was putting this collection together. Mm. And that became one of the unifying themes, and it also made me realize how much I really enjoy cooking and having a glass of wine, and so my characters do as well. It's kind of a way to extend those fulfillments into my writing.
Well, people do tend to gather in the kitchen and around the hearth, as they say, so that must have just come through for you. Aside from that, is there an overall theme, relationships, or that you had for these stories?
Again, you know, it's just what I was writing when I was writing all of these stories, and I realized that after the fact when I was putting the stories together. I mean, I knew that that's something that I tend to write about, but I wasn't writing toward a dining theme or toward a relationship theme. Mm-hmm. Those themes just emerged as I was writing and helped me to choose which stories to put in this collection and which stories to leave out.
Okay. And as we mentioned before, your connection here to Kalamazoo is that you earned your MFA here. Can you tell us a little bit more about that experience? Who did you work with here?
Yeah, my years in the MFA program at WMU were some of the most important years in my career and in my life. So far, I studied with Stuart Dybeck and Jamie Gordon, my two fiction professors, and they were just really wonderful teachers. I couldn't have asked for a better graduate school experience. And I remain in touch with Stu and Jamie regularly. They blurb to my book, and I go to them with questions or, you know, for their opinions, and they've just remained mentors. And I don't know, I mean, I just feel very lucky to have them still a phone call or an email away.
Now, back to the MFA. Now, I've seen a lot of articles, you know, where writers or critics recently have been talking about the value of having an MFA, a master's in fiction. And, you know, the talk is sometimes that it can ruin a writer's originality. What do you think about that?
You know, I have heard that too, and I've read that too, and the term the workshop story, and
yeah, formula.
You know, and it's of course talked about in a negative way, and I just that always feels a little. I mean, I can understand people's concerns with that, but I never felt any of that pressure myself. I've only ever written what I'm drawn to write, and I really form is a big concern for me in my work. Finding a form or a structure or a philosophy behind the structure that informs the meaning of the piece, and that's always just a story by story decision or creation. And I've never felt any pressure to write toward any kind of median, so to speak. And so, no, I mean, it's not true to my experience in graduate school, or even in the conversations I had in workshop with my peers. I mean, we were all mm-hmm. writing such different stuff. I have a hard time really even trying to figure out what the workshop story would be, because there was such a varied work.
And what inspires a story idea for you? Because you certainly have a collection of very unique ideas.
Thank you. You know, different things, but I always, the raw material of a story for me always encompasses a strong idea of setting, whether it's a real place or an imagined place, and a situation between characters, a conflicting situation. I might not know the exact conflict when I get the idea, but I have kind of this general idea of a situation that is holding these characters together. And so a situation, characters, setting, and some imagery, and usually a phrase or a piece of language, kind of these disparate parts. And once I've gathered that, or those things come together, then I can start writing, and it just takes off from there.
Okay. And at what point, what, or whether your own work or someone else's, what makes a story a great story for you?
Well, I can talk about, I guess I'll answer first with my own work. A great story for me, I guess, is a story that keeps me engaged the whole time I'm writing, and I feel like there's something that I'm getting at. I never know exactly what it is until I write the ending, but something that holds my interest and my attention, and that there it feels to me like there's something important that I need to discover. And then I just trust that if it's important to me, or if I find it interesting, then someone else or some other readers in the world will as well. We're just not that different, you know, when it comes down to what means the most to us or what's important to us in our lives. And then I guess really the same thing for when someone else writes a story, whatever it's about or what the style is or the voice, subject matter, as I mentioned, it doesn't really matter as long as it feels like there's something there. There's something worth learning or experiencing, or a character has something that is going to bring some kind of clarity or piece of knowledge or just emotional wisdom to my life. I know that's kind of general, but I feel like that's the only way I can really answer that question.
All right. And some of your stories are quite humorous, and some are very serious. And there's quite a bit of discomfort, too. When I was reading through the collection, this uncomfortable sense that you get at the same time that you're intrigued to know what happens. For example, your title story, Lovers Set Down the Spoons, is about married people sitting at a table, and over their dinner conversation is about the infidelity that happened. Or there's a story called Neighbors with two very incompatible couples, and one wants to make friends and the other one feels stalked. There's this element of uncomfortableness. Is that something that intrigues you?
Yeah, it really is. And those are probably two of the greatest examples to bring up from the book. People are interesting, and just the situations that we get ourselves involved in. It's interesting. It's intriguing for me to put these people in together and see what happens. And that's why, yeah, they do usually end up at some point around a dining table, because we have to eat a few times a day, and that's you know, one of the primary times when we see each other, and one of the excuses we use to get together socially with people is to share a meal. And so it's a setting ripe with dramatic possibility. And so I tend to include at least a meal in mm-hmm. almost every story. But yeah, I really am interested in how people deal with these difficult relationship situations that people tend to find themselves in, and writing is a good way to do that, just to explore and give these people, these characters, some tight quarters and where they have to face whatever it is that they're facing. That's another one of my primary interests, which is related, of course, as you pointed out, to the dining settings that repeat.
Mm-hmm. And then you're also a rule breaker, and I mean that in a good way, and that could put to rest anybody saying that an MFA makes a formula writer, because I don't think you are. Your final story, which is called Before the Story Ends. Now, when I was in school, they always said, don't write in second person, and that's exactly what you do. You read this story, and again, there's almost a little element of discomfort there, because that, mm-hmm. that writer, you're saying you, it's your parents and how you mm-hmm. were conceived, and that's mm-hmm. that's really interesting. So talk to us about breaking rules.
Yeah, rules, I think I break most rules. I'll get back to the second person in a moment. I break most rules, I think, in terms of form or structure, as I mentioned. It's one of my primary interests in writing is finding an organization that informs the material that I'm writing about. So it's not just a story about character A and character B and what happens to them, but also the arrangement of it, the kind of the artistry behind that. Gives its own set of rules, and so it's not necessarily the inverted triangle or the kind of the plot that a lot of readers like to read for. I would say plot isn't one of my primary interests in writing. In some stories, there definitely is a strong plot, but I tend to prioritize imagery and language a bit over plot at some points, but I think that imagery can do a lot of the work that plot does. If you have a strong image in a story, that image can almost tell its own story. And so if you have strong imagery, I feel like it takes a little pressure off the plot. So that's one way that I, if we're going to talk about rule breaking, that I think I don't follow those kinds mm-hmm. of rules very closely. And then with second person, I use the second person in the first story and in the last story. And I never really felt like I couldn't use second person. It's more finding a way to use it that's meaningful and it's not just gimmicky, that it adds something mm-hmm. to the story, that it seems like the only way you could tell the story.
Mm-hmm. And you do have some of these, there's 15 stories, and some of them can be very short when you were just talking about snapshots over plot. And some of those, to me, they were gorgeous images, but yeah, it wasn't really so much a story as I felt like you were just interested in capturing an image.
Yeah, definitely an image. And as I mentioned, I do feel like there are stories inherent in images, and especially in those short pieces, I really focus on that and kind of let the image do a lot of the work for me. Mm-hmm. And that's why I feel like I'm able to be satisfied with the story in when it's only a couple of pages long.
Yeah. And what are you working on now, Heather?
I received a couple of Minnesota Arts grants to travel to Krakow, not this past summer, but the summer before, to do research on a novel that I'm working on. It's about it. it follows two characters who are based on my paternal grandparents. This is a very different way of writing for me. I tend to write not very close to my life, and if I do, I fictionalize a lot of it because otherwise I tend to get stuck. So this is a different way of writing in that I once knew these two people, so I'm having to really find the right balance of truth behind these characters and fiction so that I can imagine them and I don't feel like I'm just writing about my grandparents. Anyway, so it takes place in Krakow, and it actually opens up after their deaths, and it takes place in contemporary Krakow, and it's kind of a story of a marriage, of a lifelong marriage, and what you have to endure in order to stay together. Does that give you enough of a picture? It's kind of hard to talk about when I'm in the middle of it.
No, it's fascinating. Okay. Was this your first time back to Poland? So that's your ethnic background?
Yeah, my family comes from Poland. We don't know exactly where. When my great grandparents came over, they didn't want to talk about that. They wanted to be American. They wanted their kids to have the American experience. So we have very little record of where they actually came from in Poland. I went to Krakow for the first time. Oh, how many years ago now? Maybe it was about 8 or 9 years ago when I studied in the Prague Summer Program at Western, which, of course, is a wonderful study abroad program. Mm-hmm. And after Prague, my husband and I went to Krakow for about a week or 10 days. And then I got the story idea following that first trip, and then I applied for this grant to go back and spend an extended period of time there, Minnesota is a great state for arts grants, and so I was fortunate enough to receive two, just so I could take a long trip and take a little time off teaching in order to get this book underway.
Well, let us know when it's all done and in print. Would love to read that and talk to you about that at that time.
Oh, definitely. Thank you.
Are you planning any trips to Kalamazoo to do any readings, anything like that?
Yeah, I'm working with the English department at WMU to come for a reading hopefully next fall. And also I've been in touch with Dean at Michigan News Agency to do a reading at her bookstore next time I'm in town, and then hopefully at one of the libraries. So yes, and I'll definitely be in touch when I have those lined up, probably over the summer and next fall.
Okay. And to finish up, I'd love to have you read something from your book just to give our listeners a taste of your work.
Okay, sure. I think what I'm going to read is just the first section here, the first couple of short sections of a story called Iris and the Inevitable Sorrow, or The Knock at the Door. In the oldest part of the city, on a street bustling with foot traffic, a young woman named Iris and her fiancé, Stephen, opened an English-language bookshop so small it gave one the feeling of standing inside a painted telephone booth. The city was cosmopolitan and known for its multilingual readers, and so seemed a good place for the American couple to go into business. One afternoon in February, Iris put on her long herringbone coat and went to post some mail, leaving Stephen in the window, changing the display to Sappho, Euripides, Shakespeare, the Brontes, D.H. Lawrence, writers whose age-old understanding of the interrelation between tragedy and love, of the dependency of one on the other, was sure to sell that month. As she walked past the bookshop, Iris waved to Stephen, who, halfway up the ladder, was stringing silver hearts from the ceiling. A quarter of an hour later, when she returned, the shop was locked and Stephen was not inside. A half dozen hearts dangled above her head. The rest lay lifeless on the top rung of the ladder. On the wooden desk, piled with books and papers, was a red envelope scribbled with her name. Inside was a card with a small pink heart on the cover, and upon opening it, she found in Stephen's handwriting the words, "I've met someone." Underneath his signature, he apologized for the misleading card, but Valentines were all he could find in the shop. When Iris returned home that evening to their third-floor flat in the narrow three-story building, Stephen's shoes were not on the doormat. His coat was not hanging on the coat tree. His toothbrush was not next to hers in the cup. His shirts weren't hanging in the closet. His socks were missing from his drawer. Iris took off her coat and sat at the table for a long time, which in reality was only a few minutes, but to her it felt like eternity. Then there was a knock at the door. Iris opened it and saw Mirek, the retired chef from the floor below, holding on a silver tray a glass teapot filled with a rose-colored tea and a plate of cold sandwiches. He was surprised to immediately see the young woman's hopeful face, which, upon seeing his, resumed its woe. "You must eat," he said, setting the tray on the kitchen counter. Then he descended the three-dimensional S of the staircase. Because Iris knew the world can do what it wants, she did not linger in her despair. The next morning, she unlocked the door of the bookshelf and finished hanging the hearts. She spent the week sorting and shelving books, waiting on readers, placing orders, and marking numbers in the ledger. She found herself climbing the ladder with an increased frequency and soon began to miss the ease with which she once handed to Stephen the books whose shelves she could not reach. And because she could not stop the thought that was already on its way, she pictured Stephen's long limbs entwined with another woman's, and from that point forward, each day grew twice as long as the last. On Saturday evening, when the week was over and she returned home, there was a note on the door that read, "I invite you for supper this night," and Iris promptly found herself sitting at the kitchen table while Mirek prepared the meal, the back of her chair pressed against the yellow and green striped wallpaper. The window to her left overlooked the same Art Nouveau buildings and sidewalk cafes as her living room window one floor above. The orange trolley car was stopped on the tracks in the middle of the street, and people were climbing up and down its three steep steps. Mirek's back faced Iris as he worked at the gas stove, the saucepan gurgling, a cloud of fog rising from the pot of water. His body resembled the blocky shape of the stove, and a few stray hairs stood on top of his balding head, shiny with sweat. He carried two plates with meat and dumplings to the table, and they ate in silence, looking up only to sip their wine. After dinner, Mirek fixed coffee on the stove. He poured it into two white cups, set them on saucers, and carried them to the table. "My wife left me many years ago," he said, dropping a sugar cube into his coffee and stirring it with a small spoon. "I was still quite young." Iris looked up for her cup from her cup. Did she say why? Something would change if she did? No, nothing. Mirek dropped another sugar cube into his cup. As he stirred, he said, "Being alone is not so terrible. You can have more charge of your life when you are alone, not complete charge. No one can have that. Just more." His spoon made a soft chime when he set it against his saucer. "But first you must stop being in love. This part is not for fun." A lemony light touched the railing as Iris circled up the staircase. She stopped at the window to look out. The street was empty but for the moon, which, having nothing to do itself, kept surveillance.
Thank you, Heather. Appreciate your taking time to talk with us today.
Thanks for inviting me. It was great to speak with you.